Get after it, PDX. In-depth conversations with inspiring people in the creative hotbed of Portland, Oregon, and beyond. Now, let's welcome the host of Get After It PDX and the co-founder of Y East Wolfpack, Willie McBride.
Hey folks, a quick word about our sponsors. The Amesir Distilling Company, a new distillery focused on bringing people together through great flavors and a warm environment. They love the way spirits taste, but more importantly, they love that they bring people together to make memories, build bridges, and crystallize the moment. Opening in spring 2020 in Northeast Portland. Today's episode is also brought to you by Daybreak Racing, a Portland, Oregon company offering some of the finest trail running events and trail stewardship opportunities available today. Daybreak Racing has been uniting the adventurous and wild-hearted with the mountain, coast, and forest trails of the Pacific Northwest since 2016. Adventure begins at Daybreak. Visit them at daybreakracing.com.
Welcome, folks. We are back with another episode of Get After It PDX. As always, we have a very wonderful, very special guest. Today we have Hannes Gehring, who is an ultra runner, basketball coach, and founder of Tails and Trails Dog Hikes. Technically, today is a Get After It PDX and Beyond episode because Hannes is located in Colorado. So welcome, Hannes.
Thanks, Willie. I appreciate you having me on.
So we're going to chat. We're going to throw it back. We've got a lot of good stuff to talk about. You just did a huge adventure, Nolan's 14. We're going to throw it back and hear about the OG days where you actually grew up not in this country, correct?
That is correct. Yeah. I was raised in Germany.
Germany? So whereabouts in Germany? What? Tell us the story there.
I always joke that it was, well, I literally always just say it's the bottom left, so near Stuttgart, and my parents were missionaries over there for an organization called Campus Crusade, so they actually had been there for 30 years in total, but I was there for like 11, going on my 12th year of life. We moved right at about 11 and a half, so I feel like when I identify or try to remember my childhood, I remember Germany, but I remember Lake Oswego and Oregon, and I just feel like that feels more like home. And it's I have two siblings, and we always talk about just how we have like a really different view of nationality, just because I think for me, especially being as young as I am, it was probably the easiest, or I was the youngest, so it was the easiest to like come to the States and re-identify as an American. But for my sister, it was like her junior year of high school. So,
oh, wow.
You know, like we always like go around talking about how we, I think, understand that our nationality, or at least our sense of nationality, is like probably skewed from what the average American might have, in a sense of just like if you truly grow up here with all your roots being in the States. Yeah. I just think it's a little different, you know. I schooling was like dramatically different when I came to the States.
How was it different, or what were the most sort of the most obvious ways in which it differed?
They were just on like two different extremes. In Germany, you had a really strict system. In the U.S., it felt like it was really loose. And I think like somewhere in the middle would probably have been like, in my mind, ideal. Because Germany was just like, they were ruthless about holding kids back. So they were really tough about the way that they did school and the expectations that they had for students.
So you mean strict as in not just like disciplinary wise, but just in every sort of aspect of just being serious about all the aspects?
Yeah, like I have a good example of when, this is like arts and crafts too, but we were making these angels for like a Christmas time of year. Okay. And I'm not good at art, just like admittedly not my arena. And the angel I was making was like looking pretty terrible, how we were making it. And the teacher just came by, ripped the head off, threw it in the trash can and said, start over. And, you know, I was a third grader. So you just, I don't think you're going to see that type of schooling in the U.S. I also like, there's also just this difference in structure, because at your fourth grade level, after that year, you basically get a recommendation from the teacher that's had you for 2 years as to whether you can go to Hauptschule, Realschule, or Gymnasium, which basically means like Hauptschule, your kids are really struggling, they're practically flunking out. Middle of the rung, Realschule, it's kind of like they could be doing better, but it's a great place and you could potentially get good jobs from that school. And then there's Gymnasium, which is like for these kids have been excelling, they're smart, they're bright, they're engaged, and it's really hard. That like difficulty level goes up too.
Okay.
That's fourth grade.
that's at fourth grade where kids get sent to these. Wow.
Yeah. And then it goes to like, and there's an opportunity. Look, like things might be different now. Things might have changed a lot for all I know, but this is how it was when I was there. And I remember it all really well from how the structure was set up, because it just felt intense even then, being like, well, fourth grade, that's right when we moved. So I missed that. I was right at the end of fourth grade, and both of my siblings had gone to the smart people school, or like we joke all of that. And so I still remember my parents basically like had to beg my teacher of third and fourth grade to recommend that I could go to all three, because we were moving anyways and it didn't matter. And my parents knew that it would like affect me if I wasn't recommended to all three, but my teacher didn't want to. So my parents fought for me and I got the recommendation to the smart kids school, even though I moved to the States.
Yes, that recommendation meant everything.
although it may, technically kind of fraudulent, the recommendations, and she wanted to not, but
well, so yeah. a few more questions about the Europe years. So you had two siblings?
I do, both older. Okay. One brother, one sister. Sister's the oldest.
All right. And so you said your parents were missionaries over there. That was their reason for being over there in the first place. So were you, that begs the question, were you raised with a certain religion?
Yeah, absolutely. I was raised, well, I wouldn't say that there was a denomination, but Christian, like a Lutheran leaning. My parents worked for an organization called Campus Crusade for Christ, and my dad was an ordained minister. So, yeah, it was a huge part of our life. We weren't really forced to go to church, at least not the way that I can remember, but it was just a really big piece of my childhood, definitely growing up. It was a huge, huge piece of my life growing up in Germany.
So, the style of the podcast is sort of free-flowing. We just sort of bounce around chronologically. So, I'm just going to stick with this topic right now, is to now fast forward to present day. It's like, what, you know, does that religion still play a role in your life? Or because you said, obviously it's affected you and it impacted you during these formative years. So, you know, if maybe you're not directly following that religion per se at this point, then how did it affect you? You know, what ways?
No, I end up attending a Baptist university. So I ended up actually going through college. I think I called myself and considered myself a Christian. I don't think I do anymore. At least I don't identify as one. I think I'm constantly asking myself questions about what God is and if he exists. You know, I think I haven't answered that for myself yet. I think I'm somebody that's like a genuine seeker of truth. I'm a believer in, if I can, see something as true and real, then I want to have an open heart to believing in that. And I that was a really challenging thing to like go through. Basically, this like, I think I was about 24, 23, 25, somewhere in there, that it just started to, for me, not make sense anymore. I didn't believe in a lot of the things that I kind of had grown up with on that angle. And I don't think I've answered really for myself fully what higher power exists or how they interact with us. I think for me, there's a lot of things that don't feel like they're coincidence. And I think we'll get to this, but we'll talk about it. There's kind of thinking about things that aren't coincidence. When I thought of carrying names to the peak of each peak for my attempt on Nolan's, and we'll probably elaborate more, I just had like no doubt in my heart that that's what I was supposed to do. I just knew I didn't really, it almost felt like I didn't come up with the idea. And so when you have moments like that, that feel like borderline spiritual in the way that it's like, hey, I'm meant to do this way. I know I need to do this way. And I don't really know why, but I just know that I need to. And that for me was exactly how it felt for my Nolan's attempt, was that I had a really specific purpose, and it felt like just like entrenched in my heart that that's what I was supposed to do. Was I was supposed to make this about something more than myself, and I was supposed to make it about Black Lives Matter, and I felt really devoutly in that. And I just think like correlating the two, for me it's hard to like completely, while I don't necessarily identify as a Christian, I also find it really challenging to completely rule out the divine or a higher power that maybe Christianity is misunderstood, and maybe the God that I was raised to believe in isn't exactly, in my mind, accurate. Events that are that you know are bigger than yourself, and that you connect with on a really spiritual level. And I think most ultra runners, and I shouldn't speak for them all, but at least for me, when you're out there on a trail and you're just kind of like in your own world, feeling completely free, that feels spiritual, and that feels like bigger than just even your surroundings or like yourself. I didn't know we're gonna go so deep.
We're going deep.
No,
baby.
I'm just kidding. I don't mind talking about it. It's definitely been a huge part of my life, and I'm really challenging. My brother's a minister in Oregon, and my dad's still out there, and they do a lot of work for the church, and they're my sister's out there too, and I love them all to death, right? Yeah. And it's definitely been, I think, from my perspective, what's been truly amazing is that I have these four people, my dad, my mom, brother, sister, who have, like, and I don't need to speak for their beliefs, I just can say that they, in the way that I've approached my stepping away from Christianity, I adore the way that I've been treated. My family loves me. I know that. I love them back. And it's just, I think from that perspective, it's been cool to see that they've allowed me the freedom to be myself and still just love me, even if maybe they disagree. So, it's a huge, huge.
These are big topics. Big topics.
Yeah, totally.
So we'll rein it in. We're gonna jump back again. So, at this pivotal point, you make this move all the way across the seas back to the States. Because you were born in Europe, but you come stateside and you head to Oregon. So what prompted the move and why Oregon? Why Lake Oswego?
My folks had like a contact in Lake Oswego. And part of the other reason was it made my parents comfortable. It's a really, really good school system. So it's an affluent area, just an awesome, awesome place to grow up, quite frankly. But the school district is just known to be phenomenal, too. So my dad was originally from Oregon. My parents had always kind of wanted us to get back home. I think my parents considered America home, and they kind of knew there was this point, like, either we move or we never do, kind of. And so I think that point kind of came, and we moved to Oregon, I think, in large part to my dad's ties and a lot of family. He had 8 siblings. One of them was passed, but just a really, really big family with lots of cousins and uncles. And so I think there was that, kind of wanting to be around family a little bit more for my dad, and then having a few connections, that it just kind of made sense that if we were going to relocate back to the States, that we went there. I loved growing up in the Northwest. Like, it's so funny now, because I don't remember the rain. You know what I mean? I live in Colorado now, and I just say that, like, because we have a ton of sun and a lot of sun. And now when I go home and I visit, I notice the rain. And I just say, like, all growing up, and because I left when I was, like, 26. And I loved the Pacific Northwest. I wasn't into the same things. I played basketball. I definitely wasn't outdoorsy. My brother at one point asked me to go hiking, and I told him, why would you want to walk slowly uphill? It sounds painful.
And now look what you do. You walk slowly uphill, and it's so painful.
That was like the idea I had of hiking. I don't think I really understood. It just sounded like work. I was really heavily involved in Young Life through high school, and like a lot of my like childhood in Oregon. So I got to go to these really cool places. Like, I went to British Columbia 3 times. Like, they had camps in like really sweet spots, and there was inevitably like a hike or something. And I always I think I always enjoyed that element. I was just like, I was in shape for basketball. Yeah. And so you get out there on a trail, and it's just like, you can't quite, you're like, you think you're a fit dude, but you're getting your kind of butt handed to you. So you're like, I think as a high schooler, my pride just like had a hard time with it. In college, I played basketball. So there were weekends, you know, between games and shoot arounds and practices, there just wasn't like, I didn't have the time. I kind of, looking back, I don't really think I did have the time. You know, just when you're playing basketball in college, you spend so much time. You get there to warm up. Like, I was like an old man too. I just was like, I had to get there an hour early to get warm. I had to like get in the warm tub, get stemmed, get wrapped. It was just this whole process.
So when did this love of basketball really take hold?
That was probably my sophomore going into my junior year. I had a coach just pull me aside, Jonathan Oldmans, and I just say his name because like he's one of the first mentors I feel like I ever had, and just one of the coolest. He was a teacher, he was a coach, one of my coaches, and just one of the best people that's ever come into my life. And he told me my sophomore year, he said, you could play in college, but you got to stop being a post. You need to be a guard. And so I was like this sophomore who I thought I was kind of average at basketball. And it lit a fire. Like, that was one huge reason I fell in love with basketball and realized, like, hey, maybe I could be kind of good. And that, like, just turned into, and I, no exaggeration, 1,000 shots a day. Like, after my sophomore year, I really recognized, like, hey, this is just all practice. It's just this, and I got to catch up because I didn't grow up playing basketball in Germany. So my dad would get out there and rebound for me. He'd stand under the hoop and he'd bat the ball back at me, and we'd do sets of 100. And I'm not, no exaggeration, I feel like people think I'm a crazy person when I tell them I shot 1,000 shots, 1,000 three-pointers a day, because that's all we did. I never shot mid-range. I always shot three-pointers. And I don't even know why. I just went, and like, I shouldn't say never, because we do a couple hundred mid-range, but it was like 90-10, you know, percentage-wise.
Wait, so how's your three-pointer today?
It's so broke.
Oh, no, man. What? After all that?
Oh, yeah, I coach, and, like, the my players, like, when we play one-on-one and stuff, they just, like, segue off me and make fun of me and tell me I can't shoot. But I've had like, a couple of times where I've been able to show them that it's still there. Like, look, it comes back, but I've played in a couple of, like, men's leagues, and I don't know. At this point, I think it's probably in my head even, but, man, it is not good. And I had to practice. Basketball for me was always, like, not natural. I actually had to just practice a ton to even be, like, some of the things I was good at naturally, but shooting, I wasn't. I have a friend who could, like, he could take 2 weeks off and it didn't matter. Like, he'd just come back in the gym and he'd be good at shooting. But me, I, like, take 2 days off and I can't hit the broadside of a barn. So,
what do you think made you fall in love with it? I mean, I know sometimes it's hard to pinpoint, and it can be a blend of things, but, you know, just trying to dig deeper, what do you think really hooked you?
Well,
you said you're that coach. Well, so what, from the outside, like, if that coach said something to you about, hey, maybe gave you that little bit of, like, kick of, you know, excitement of, like, I'm actually might be good at something. That's a pretty addictive feeling of, like, hey, I'm worthy. I'm good. So was it that, or, like, what else?
What? I think I recognized I could be good. Like, yeah. Right, yeah. I had this coach who, like, breathed life into me, who kind of gave me, like, this huge spark, we can call it.
So you were just high on the confidence of, like, having this guy's...
No, it was... I recognized that you could literally just practice. And I know this sounds really... That sounds really stupid if I say... You could just practice and get better, of course. But with basketball, it felt like there was no ceiling. It just felt like, hey, every ounce I put into this is a direct correlation to, like, how good, you know, you start realizing, like, how good you're getting at shooting, and it's just really fun. Like, I was playing in these super competitive, it was called Costco Sports Nation. It was an old Costco that was turned into, like, this huge, like, super gym. It had 14, 15 courts. I'm not even kidding, like, 14 courts. Yeah, it had a huge indoor hockey field, indoor soccer, like, just all the gym equipment you could possibly imagine. It's just a huge place. Wow. And with all those courts, like, they got some really, really competitive games going on. And going, like, into my junior year, and, like, I'm practicing a lot, and then I wouldn't play a ton because I thought it was the slowest way to get better if I just scrimmaged, but I would shoot, do a bunch of dribbling drills, and then jump into a couple of games, and it was like, the games would go to 11, and I'd score every point, and I'm not, to pat yourself on the back. Only reason I say that is because you asked, like, what was it? It's like, well, that's addicting, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
When you're starting to recognize that, like, your hard work is going, it's working, and people are like, do you always shoot like this? And you're like, no, like, obviously not. But, like, the hard work is paying off, and I'm getting kind of good at this, is what I'm thinking in my mind. So there was that. There was just this love for, like putting the work in and recognize. Look, I was kind of coming into my own my junior year of high school. I feel like I was starting to realize like how you can be funny and how you can just be. Being more comfortable in my own skin completely. Like I was always pretty comfortable, but I just remember my junior year, it all kind of like clicked. And I think some of that was physical too, where my, like, I was kind of reaching this athletic peak, and starting to grow into my own as far as coordination and all of my best traits kind of, as far as, because I played football and soccer too, and I really enjoyed those experiences, but I didn't connect with the sports the way that I did with basketball. And I think a lot of that was just like, I'm recognizing I could be super good at this. All my attributes that athletically I have are like, you know, they correlate well to the sport. I loved playing defense. So, like, there was, I think there was an element of basketball more than any other sport where, like, one person could just have such a profound impact, if that makes sense. Like, I'm not the person that had the profound impact, but Kevin Love, who I played with in high school, he was the guy that had, you know, it's like, it's just one of those sports where all the work you put in, it's, you get to see it translate. And then when you do play, you know, it's like all eyes on you. There's no helmet. Soccer, the crowd's far away. It's just this really intimate sport. And I think I was loving growing from it. Like, that sounds so cliche. I grew from it as a person, but it's like,
that's true though, of course.
It's totally true. I was just growing as a human, as a young lad. I was just like learning so many lessons from basketball that I felt like that you can take later, where you're like, man, if you just work really hard, and that's like, for me, I feel like basketball more than any other sport too. You're like, the work you put in correlates directly to results because it's so fine motor, and like you can just dribble a bunch and get better. You can shoot a bunch and get better at it, and it's just, I think for the most part, fairly easy to find a hoop and a place. And like with soccer, it's just like, it's harder to get, just like go practice, you know?
Well, so obviously there's a lot of crossover, and we're going to talk more about this later, but with running and all, obviously now running is a huge part of your life and a huge passion for you, and requires a ton of practice. And sort of like basketball, where you could dribble a ball anywhere, it's like you can run anywhere, basically.
Yeah, it's very true.
So, but we're going to pull it back again. So you go to college based off playing ball?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So was that a scholarship, or what was the deal there? Where'd you go?
No. In fact, my freshman year, I went to a different college. Like, I cared so much about basketball that I transferred after my freshman year, because I didn't, like, I don't want to like badmouth the coach or anything, it just, like, I could tell he had a system that I wasn't going to be happy in, and so I decided to transfer, and then it was a scholarship. So my freshman year is actually almost entirely academic, just grants. And my mom, bless her heart, like found so many scholarships for me to apply to in high school. Mm-hmm. So I would just like apply. I felt like I applied to 30. It was probably like 5. I was in like choir and a couple, you know, played sports. So I think I just had like, I fit this niche for a lot of these scholarships and kept getting lucky and kept writing essay and after essay after essay. And so my freshman year, I was super lucky to have most of school covered through like academic stuff and grants. And then, like, as I transferred to Corbin University, it went from NCAA to NAIA. And so they were able to do academic as well as athletic, because Division III NCAA, they can't do athletic scholarships. At least that's how it was when I was there. And I think that's still the same, but I could be wrong. The school I went to was super, it was definitely really religious. I had like segregated dorms and had to sign a contract that you wouldn't take part in certain activities, and all that was fine with me. I didn't even like, I was fine with the experience. I don't think I would like, I don't know if I'd go there again if I could redo it, but I also loved basketball and it was my best opportunity to really play. So grass is always greener, but if I did it again, I'm not sure if I'd play college basketball. I go back and forth, but like some days I'm like, oh, I'd never play if I wouldn't do it. Cause there's something to be said about just kind of like going to a bigger school and having this awesome college experience and kind of like blending in. And I think there's a lot of fun factors about having like a really big school be your, is it alma mater? Yeah, we can call it that. Mm-hmm. But I think that's high school. But anyway, so I really enjoyed playing college basketball, and that's why I go back and forth on like if I would again. Mm-hmm. It's such a commitment, and it's such a like you sacrifice on a lot of just kind of freedom that exists during college years. That I never really felt like I was sacrificing though. So,
What came after college?
I spent a couple years in Portland.
Okay.
A few years, about three, I think, maybe a little more. And I was in Southeast, right next to the Baghdad Theater. Nice. We were just one house off Hawthorne.
Wow.
Yeah, it was such a sweet spot. Like, and that's why I fell in love with Portland. Like, I kind of had a suburban experience of Oregon, you know? I didn't have, like, a ton of exposure to Portland's proper. Yeah. And when I was in Southeast, and like, just, literally, we would go watch, like, I remember us watching a Civil War, Oregon State game at the Baghdad Theater, and it's like that part of town was so fun and it was so up and coming, and it was already like happening, so it wasn't, now it's even crazier, but like it was even pretty fun then.
And so what year was that?
What that years was were those? 2008 going into 2009.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so 2008 going into 2009, and yeah, that was like,
man, it was very different. That's right before I got to town. I got there in like 11.
Oh man, that whole part of town. It was literally like I didn't need to go anywhere but Hawthorne for my weekly food. Wow. Eastside Deli. Oh,
yeah. Good.
And I was there with I had a couple roommates. So I was like fresh out of college. I was a little bit lost because I was doing this financial services gig and I knew I kind of hated it. At the very least, I knew I wasn't going to do it long term. Mm-hmm. And I think once you kind of make that realization, at least for me, once I get to the point where I'm like, I'm not going to do this long term, I try to figure out a way to like make a plan or just exit. And even if I don't have a perfect plan, and that's kind of what I did there. I did not have a perfect plan. I had a tiny bit of money saved up from my first job out of college. But I remember just like walking into my b- boss, she was awesome and a super understanding human. And just being like, I just woke up with a pit in my stomach. Like, this is not where I'm supposed to be. And she's like, I get it. It's just like, not that I always have things that clear, but every now and then I feel like I've understood, like, hey, this is not what I'm supposed to be pursuing. This isn't the direction I want to be going. That was one of them. And part of it was, I was starting to lose friends to, like, moving. So I'd have a friend leave to go to San Diego. I'd have a friend leave to go to wherever. Like, I just was having a lot of my social circle felt like it was starting to wander. Mm-hmm. And it started making me want to, like, just maybe look at doing the same. And a year or two later, after living in that house on Hawthorne, I just was like, I'm really ready to move somewhere else.
Was there something specific about the job that wasn't vibing with you? Or was it like the style of job, like being at a desk in front of a computer, or like the high stress? Or what was it specifically that you sort of knew deep down wasn't for you?
Well, I stayed in that industry for almost a decade, more than a decade.
Okay.
And it wasn't like where I went, because a lot of the time I spent in Portland, I was working for the bank. I was working for Chase. And I really actually enjoyed that. I think I was like, I was better at it. And what my first job, you were being asked to go into schools, right? And basically work with teachers on the retirement plan. But a lot of it, you had to be really, like, bold. There's no other way of, like, describing it other than you just had to be super bold to get into the building sometimes. And so, that doesn't mean you do anything crazy. You just have to go talk to the secretary and, like, make her forget that you're not supposed to just walk in. And then you start going to each room and talking to teachers about their retirement plan and trying to help them with it. And while you were legitimately helping them, there were just a lot of these like super uncomfortable things that I felt like I was being asked to do repeatedly. And none of them really breaking any rules, none of them like illegal or wrong. And then once like the school got to know you, obviously it got comfortable and they were fine with you being there. But there was this like early point where I'm coming out of college and my first introduction to work is like, you know, kind of going guerrilla warfare on like, you know, elementary schools and middle schools and high schools, trying to just get into the building. So there was a genuine discomfort with that, like, at the entire time I did it. And we weren't doing anything wrong. We weren't selling them anything illegal. A lot of them needed what we were offering. And I feel like there's a reason why it kind of happened the way that it did. But for me, I kind of knew, I was like, I'm not going to do this forever. And it didn't last long. I think it was like, I'm not sure if I got through a year on that one. Yeah. You know, like, look, you're this kid out of college too, and it's like, you know, super lucrative, and you're just getting these paychecks that you're like, what's happening? You know, like, I didn't know people made money like this. And then at the same time, you're like, it's funny how you can frame things in a way that makes sense for you when you're in it. And then, like, looking back and just describing that to you, it just sounded horrible. Like, what do you mean you were going guerrilla warfare on elementary? Yeah. It's like, well, obviously there's a purpose, and I would have to get a pass, and it wasn't anything like sneaking in back doors, but it just was, you had to be really, really bold. More bold than I think I was as a salesperson. But when you're in it, you know, like, it's like you can frame your mind that, like, what you're doing is so great for teachers and they need it so badly. Like, even just in telling you about this, I like heard myself saying like, oh, it wasn't that bad. You know, it's like, well, they needed their retirement plan and they needed help with what we offered, but we weren't the only solution and there was cheaper options and we weren't telling that to them when we came in there. So like, Anyways, this job wasn't the right.
I gotcha. But so you move, and when you relocated from Portland, where'd you go?
I went to Denver, Colorado. And at that point I was with Chase. I transferred with Chase. I was like, it was this like brainless gig where, you know, I was just pretty good at it. You're basically a customer service agent for like anybody who walks in the bank, but they call you banker. And I did that for a really long time. I kind of kept getting promoted and getting an opportunity that would keep me there at the very least. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, I'm really thankful for that job to a lot of degrees because it allowed me to get to Denver. That's where I ended up falling in love with, you know, everything outdoors. And it was definitely not immediate. For about a year, I'm really like, now it's all coming back. Man, that was a cool time, but it was just like also a really, I was getting, I wouldn't say I was getting sick of my job. I was unhappy with the stress I was being put under. And then I was unnecessarily stressing myself out, you know, like just with like anxiety and overthinking things. I was really not in a good place mentally. And part of that was I was getting really big. Like, and I say that respectfully because like I went from a 205, 210 college athlete that, you know, like worked out a ton to 230 and very soft. So it's like, it's only like a 20 pound swing or, you know, 30 pound swing. But it was the fact that I was like, I also had replaced all my muscle and I wasn't fit. I was really out of shape. And I think for me, a lot of unhappiness came from that. And I speak for nobody else. I just mean for me, I'm just not like at peace and I'm not happy with myself. And I'm definitely not like, at least at this point, I've recognized how important. And that was a huge swing. I'd come from being a college athlete to like not really finding anything to put my competitive juices towards and definitely not finding anything that like led to fitness or led to exercise. I couldn't get into a routine on anything. And even when I tried to run in Portland, and I don't know if this is because it was so wet or if it was because I was always running on cement, but I could never get into any kind of a rhythm. I couldn't get into a routine. I couldn't consistently run. I'd do a week or two okay, but then it would just go disappear. And I think part of it's weather, but more than anything, I recognized that trail running is so much gentler on my body. Mm. And I would argue on others too, but for me, especially being a big dude, I could trail run 10 miles and it's not even close to the same recovery time that I need compared to running 10 miles in the city on cement. Mm-hmm. So anytime I'd run in Portland, I just ran on cement. You know, from the house, go. And I didn't know any better. I didn't like think you could drive somewhere to run on a trail. Like, none of that even dawned on me. And that probably sounds super naive. I just like, I didn't, this wasn't in my brain, you know? Like, yeah. How do you know of trails if you've never done them? And it all sounded like so exotic, anyways, like not something that I was qualified to do. So the cement running that I would do would just beat my body up. And I recognize that now in retrospect, that once I started getting onto the trail, I could just go longer, further, more often with less recovery. I also just enjoyed it more, right? Like, it was so much easier to go 10 plus miles on a trail with beautiful surroundings than to do that running laps in the city. And that probably sounds like, well, duh, but I don't know, until you've until you've really experienced, like for me, that Nirvana trail moment where it's just, oh my gosh, this isn't the only, that you have that like realization that this isn't the only trail out there that's probably really cool, and that you're having this like experience of, man, this is incredible. Like my surroundings are incredible. This is so beautiful. I'm running. That's really cool. And you're just like, everything is coming together. And I think that, like, I kind of lost my train of thought, but the idea that, like, when you're running in that kind of a state, I think it, at least I had a moment a couple of different times where I recognized this is probably not the only trail that I could have this much fun on. And there's a lot of trails out there.
Like, you start to realize that potential of what you're
totally
doing.
Like, yeah. There's just like this idea started growing in my head of like, oh man, I might have stumbled onto something that I could really fall in love with. And I actually really fell in love with hiking first. And that didn't really happen. That happened for one reason and one reason alone. My little guy, he's underneath here, underneath the, he keeps coming up to say hi. Ollie, I adopted him. That was 8 years ago. And he, you know, like natural.
He's a dog, correct?
He is correct, yeah. Ollie is a dog, which is why he's
not a kid.
The,
you're
I'm
like,
sorry.
You're like,
oh. I should have said that. Ollie's a dog. I had gone to a bunch of shelters to try to find, because I decided I wanted a dog, but I didn't think I would adopt one for like a few months. And then the first day that I went, this dog like came up to me and licked my fingers through the grate and then rolled over, and it's this lady was like sweeping and she's literally like staring and she just stopped. I still remember the corner of my eyes. I was like, oh, I shouldn't have put my fingers. I just said, I was like, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have put my fingers in there. Like, he's just so cute. And she's like, no, I stopped sweeping because he's been barking at every single person that walks by. And the first person he hasn't barked at. And I was like, oh, you're just trying to get me to adopt a dog. Like, that's a, you know. And she's like, no, Ollie's super cute. Like, I mean, I'm obviously super biased, but Ollie's a super cute 40-pound dog. And she just ended up telling me, like, no, trust me, he'll get adopted right away. And I'm just telling you that he didn't bark at anybody. So I knew he was my buddy. And from there, I just wanted to be, like, a good dog owner. And I tried running in the city, and it wasn't really working. So I started just hiking a lot, and it was because I wanted to get him outside. I remember like the first hike we did, he like laid down 3.5 miles in. He was super tired. Like, just thinking now, he can like, I mean, all he can do 25 plus miles like comfortably and be okay the next day. But and I don't, just to be clear, I don't do that very often, if hardly ever anymore. But he's just like, it's just amazing how we've kind of grown together in this little journey of just adopted a dog. I got super into hiking, and then it turned into me looking up mountain biking routes. I still remember I would like try to find mountain biking trails or loops that I could go hike, and I would jog the downhills, and then I just like hike uphills super hard. And it just was fun to get better. Like, it was probably really similar to basketball, where yeah. I liked seeing the progress. And in when you're starting to get fitter and you're starting to, like, just for me, like, have this eye-opening experience of how cool the outdoors are, it's really addicting and fun to get out there and push yourself maybe a little bit harder than you did last time, or further, or the same distance, but know that, like, man, it's really fun. Like, you go from this, like, I can't imagine what doing 5 miles to, I can't imagine doing 10, to I can't imagine doing 15, to like, all of a sudden I'm hiking 25 mile loops, and I'm like loving it, realizing that if you hike, you can like just hit repeat the next day, you know, like, so I love the fact that I was getting better at it and I really enjoyed, I mean, I enjoyed everything about getting out. I was falling in love with being outside and seeing all these cool things. Like my favorite loop still probably in the world is that I've done is a 4-pass loop in Aspen. And it, like, it doesn't matter what time of year other than when it's snowy. Like, it doesn't matter when you do it. It's just spectacular. And I still remember hiking that, backpacking that in like a day and a half, and just, you know, around every corner it felt like this fairy tale view and fairy tale like picturesque. So it was moments like that, me like loving the fact that I was losing the weight that I had gained. You know, there's like that true reality that if you really start getting after it on the trail, you start to shed pounds. And at least that was my experience. And like, maybe that's not perfectly true for everyone, but for me it was. And it also allowed me to like enjoy the stuff that I like even more. Like I like beer, so I drink a little bit of beer without like having any guilt over it, and or eating like I want, because I can eat. So it's always like people ask me like, oh, do you run a lot because so you can just eat whatever you want? I'm like, well, no, it's a factor. It's, I don't know if it's like that simple, but it's absolutely a factor. I love the fact that I'm able to like utilize this thing I love doing, being outside, seeing beautiful things, being on trails and like adventuring, and then like having it also directly result in being good for you and healthy. You know, there's definitely like some, probably not like the only ultra runner who loves that element of, you know, like, hey, it keeps you really in really good shape.
So it's awesome though. It's all through this process of these incredible life-changing sort of eye-opening experiences. Basically all the while you had your pup right next to you, correct?
Yeah, he literally, there wasn't like a hike or something we did that he didn't come with for. And not that we did like anything too crazy, but he was always on leash too. Like I was pretty diligent and good about that for the most part. And that limits his mileage, like, you know, doing out and back. So that's helpful. And I think that's really wise to do if you're going to take a dog along anyways. But he was just right there. And I was like, you know, whether I was single at the time or not, like it was, because there was obviously waves of that where I was with somebody or not with somebody. And I just always felt like with Ollie, it just, I had this buddy that was always there no matter what, you know? And, yeah, we fell in love with getting kind of in good shape and great shape together. And then like exploring all these rad places, and like Oregon wouldn't have been a bad place to fall in love with the same things. Cause when I go back now and visit my family, which I try to a couple times, or maybe once or twice a year, like when I come back, I'm always in the gorge. I'm always in like on trails that I wished I would have explored while I was out there. So I think the same thing could have happened and maybe would have happened in Oregon had it just been a different time of my life. And like there was an admitted just desire to kind of explore something new and different and see if like maybe I just might like somewhere else. And man, like Colorado's just not shy for opportunities in the outdoor. No, it's a great place to fall in love with that.
So this love of dogs, though, is clearly love of dogs and mountains and activities, being super active, naturally led into this dog hiking business. So tails and trails, dog hikes. Tell us about this. Tell us how it got started, where you're at with it. You're a business owner and entrepreneur now.
Yeah, it was like, I'll put a long story short, a long, like, man, it's been a long time now, 7 years, I think, maybe 6 years. But I went off of a mountain road in southern Colorado, where I just flipped in the vehicle, the rental vehicle I was in.
Oh, wow.
It was like a full total of the vehicle. There was a scrape on my head where the roof came in. I mean, like, the seatbelt literally saved my life. And I just had this, like, moment of clarity where I think I realized I knew that I started needed to make progression towards, like, pursuing this running stuff more because I was falling in love with it. And that maybe I wasn't in the right world, right place work-wise. So I kind of tried to pursue a different company and did that for a few more years. It was better, but not, it was still kind of the same problems. And long story short, I just kind of ended up like saying like, okay, I'm going to move into my truck. I'm not going to work for a bit. I moved into my Tacoma, which is like for full-time living, not necessarily ideal, but still like glamping. And for almost a year, I was in the truck. So all that to say, coming back, I just didn't have work and I didn't have a job. And I was trying to come up with a way that I could, like, they say you got to try to get paid for what you love doing, you know, and I love dogs. Like, I've got 3 of them now, and they changed my life completely, you know, for the better. So I absolutely adore dogs. And then I love hiking. So I came up with a dog hiking business called Tails and Trails, Colorado Dog Hikes. So if you want to look us up, we're at tailsandtrailsco.com.
We will definitely put all that info in the show notes so people can hit it up.
Go to the website. Kidding anyways.
No, we're doing it.
But yeah, it's been fun to see that grow over the last few years. Done that since the beginning of 2018, so a couple of years now. And it's been phenomenal, just like a really, really happy way to make your living, getting up there every single day to hike. You know, sometimes it's 8, sometimes it's 12, sometimes it's 6. You know, it's a lot of dogs. Sometimes.
Number of dogs, well, sometimes 12 dogs.
Most I've done, but I really limit it to 8 now. So I shouldn't say 12 because it makes it sound crazier than it is. But it's I love what I do. We are like, we're in a transition, like moving to Crested Butte in January of next year.
Wow.
So I'm hoping to be able to continue having the business run and function, but for me, like from a personal standpoint, for like 2.5 years, it's been the single happiest way that I've earned a living ever. You know, it's, I do some other things too, but for work, it's just about as good as it gets. Yeah. Being out with a bunch of smiley, happy dogs.
That's freaking great.
Yeah.
So we want to talk about Nolan's 14 and dedicating the effort and the attempt to Black Lives Matters and holding up a name of someone who's been killed by police at the top of each of these 14 different peaks. First, tell us about Nolan's 14 in general. What is Nolan's 14? Give us the quick overview, and then we'll talk about you dedicating this effort.
Nolan's 14 is every single 14,000-foot peak from in the Sawatch Range in Colorado, which is from Leadville down to Buena Vista, down to Salida. And it kind of creates this, like, I mean, I wouldn't call it a perfect line because it's super gnarly, but it creates, there's, if you do every 14,000-foot peak, it's about 100 miles. Depending on how you do it, it can be anywhere from, like, 85 to 100 miles. But it's 44,000 feet of elevation gain and loss. So I guess you'd say 88,000 total. But you end up summiting every single one of those mountains in the process. And there's a 60-hour time limit that kind of had been set a long time ago. It's not like an official race. It's just something that you go out and requires a ton of scouting, so to spend just an inordinate amount of time on the actual line, trying to figure out where's the best way to go, and getting comfortable with the train because you're going to go through the night. But you know, for me, and I don't know if you asked this, but for me, I didn't have an ideal year training wise. It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't like what I would have dreamed up. And then, like, look, COVID, I think, probably threw a wrench for a lot of us in a lot of ways. But for me, I just had injuries. I had sometimes just my own brain getting in the way. I just didn't have the year I dreamt of. And I started wondering if, you know, maybe, like, I literally just thought, like, what if you stop thinking about yourself so much? Because when you're doing something like Nolan's, you're just, no matter how you frame it, it's a selfish endeavor. Like, you're doing it for yourself. It's to, like, for me to accomplish this goal. And because I didn't have the year I'd wanted to in training, in part, I just started thinking about, like, hey, like, is there, like, a way you could make it about something more than yourself? And right around when I'd gotten hurt was when George Floyd had been killed, and I'm two blocks from where all the protests are in Denver. So I was just in the thick of it. And I was, you know, really moved by, like, seeing white and black people marching together. I ended up protesting in the marches myself. And so I think it was just on my mind, everything. And then I say this, like, idea came to me. I don't know if it was that profound, but it did feel like it wasn't really my idea. It was just kind of like being there it was, which was to take the name of a black American that was killed to every single peak. And part of, like, for me, like, a lot of us remember Eric Garner. He was the guy he's kind of one of the first people that got caught on video getting strangled to death and saying, "I can't breathe," over and over. That was 2014. And I remember just being like, man, I remember seeing that video and thinking it was so wrong and thinking it was, like, disgusting. And yet here I am in 2020, and, like, you know, how many times has it happened in between, and I've seen it and done nothing to, like, contribute to that cause. So, and as much as anything, we just start, like, forgetting about these people, right? Like, Eric Garner happened 6 years ago, and we're all moved on with our lives. We're still living. I think at least a lot of people can see what's wrong with somebody getting strangled to death in a situation like that. And it's like, I just felt like this was an opportunity to keep the conversation in the right place and not let us forget and have it be another 6 years before. Look, like, I'm not enacting any change by bringing the names of 14 killed black Americans by police to each peak. Like, I am not in doing that in any way creating change itself, but I did feel like it could potentially bring attention to something that we keep forgetting about, and we just keep pushing down, and we keep kind of saying, yeah, that's really messed up, but, like, something needs to change. And then there was, in doing all this, like, and being in the protests and, like, learning more and kind of educating myself in areas like systemic racism and social injustice, that I kind of was like, well, wait, we had, like, the civil rights movement and it's all good, right? Like, I know that's a super naive way of putting it, but there was, I think, kind of that mentality from my perspective of, like, I didn't think things were unequal. And if you do a little research and you just start to look into, like, mass imprisonment and some of the genuine issues that are even bigger than just these killings of black Americans, it felt super real to me. And it felt something that I've connected to politically that I don't often feel like I connect to politics very at all. But this one, felt more than political. And I ended up dedicating my entire Nolan's effort to that. It felt really natural and like something that I was supposed to do. Even during my Nolan's effort itself, it just felt like I'm getting to the end. Like, there's no way I'm not finishing, because there's no way I'm not taking every single one of these names up. Like, it was just this motivation that was like, whether it was a mental trick or not, it was like so deeply ingrained in the back of my mind of like, you're not going to take 12 names up. Like, that's not okay. You're not going to take 7. That's not okay. And yet I still knew there was a ton of things out of my control on when you do something like this. And I probably should have said this when I was describing Nolan's initially, but when you do all 14 of these peaks in a row, it is not a consistent trail. So you're going through boulder fields, loose talus, scree fields. Like, you're trying to take the most direct line while fastest, while also safest. Like, it's this balance. And sometimes it's trail, but maybe, I don't know. It depends on which way you go, because it's create your own adventure. You can go a bunch of different ways on Nolan's, but no matter how you do it, you have to go over some seriously technical and gnarly terrain. So I think that, especially doing that at night, is like the biggest challenge of everything Nolan's.
Well, congrats on finishing Nolan's. That's a huge, very, very, very big accomplishment.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's so challenging because you feel like you don't have all the solutions, but I think one of the things for me, it started with like genuinely educating myself about what the problem is. There's a few documentaries out there, like 13, or that I think are really enlightening and at the very least educational. It doesn't mean that your opinion has to be the same as mine at the end of them, but I think there are ways that there's so much at our fingertips now, like literally at your fingertips for most of us with our phones. You can just Google like one of these words, social injustice or racial inequality, mass imprisonment, prison labor, and you can start educating yourself. And when, at least for me, when I started doing that and educating myself a little bit more, I also started to like get more passionate about having an impact and seeing progress. And so going, like, I don't have the solution for, racial violence towards Black Americans from the police. Like, I think there's a bunch of ways that I could suggest ideas that, somebody intelligent might be like, well, this is why that can't work. But I do think that we can do a lot better. And I think that the attention that's continued to be on it, on that subject in specific, while it bothers some people, it actually feels to me like we are seeing a little bit more progress, and we're starting to, and like, what does that even mean? I'm not politically in courtrooms, and I think this election is going to be really powerful in seeing potential real impact in that arena. You can like start to try to engage, and if you're not willing to, at the very least, do a tiny bit of research, do a tiny bit of like engaging in, is this actually an issue in our country? Like, that's for me where it starts. And educating yourself also doesn't solve it, but it might galvanize somebody with the right idea to start, like, who knows? And again, I don't have all the solutions for any of that, but I do think, I've really had my eyes open this year. I've played growing up. I played on a lot of predominantly Black, athlete basketball teams. I coached in Aurora, which is why I think the Elijah McClain scenario really hit home with me. I coached kids that age. That it was, I think I had one white kid on my team. And for me, it's almost like it was right in front of my face, how much easier I had things than any of those scenarios I just brought up. I mean, I can't compare lives with every single kid, but it was almost blatant how much easier I had it, and I knew it kind of, but it didn't seem like it felt unjust, but it felt like, well, like how do you fix that? And me being a kid at that point, or even older when I was coaching the teams, like I just thought I was, because you're around it and you're surrounded in it, I think sometimes you almost miss some of the inequality that's actually right there in front of you. I know I was. And so anyways, I wish I had a better answer for, like, what would you like to see? And having alternatives to lethal force is like step one, and teaching alternative tactics to lethal force. It seems like almost nobody in their right mind would disagree with that, like, most of these scenarios didn't require lethal force. If you go through the 14 names that I took to each peak, like, and just Google their names, I think most people could agree, like, yeah, that probably could have gone without lethal force. Like, it's that element that we need to see change in. And then, yeah, I hope we start attacking some of those other elements, like corporations profiting off prison labor and understanding just how crooked that is.
I see a theme of today's podcast, which is the importance of practice. So whether it's basketball, it's like every single shot, you're shooting thousands of shots a day, or every single time you dribble that ball, that's practice towards improvement, towards getting better. When you're running, it's like every single foot strike, just as simple as every single dribble, as every single shot, every single foot strike is leading you towards this practice of becoming better and improving. And it's just the same as, you know, becoming a more politically active person, a more engaged person with important social issues and environmental issues around you. It's like step by step is how you practice, is how you improve, is how you establish, is how you grow. So we're going to finish with the question I ask everyone. I'm sort of going to tailor it a little bit more to you, which is, so the question always is, like, because this podcast is largely about, you know, people who are doing cool things and how they sort of got there, you know, and their life story, twists and turns and what have you. So, and then I ask people's advice for maybe somebody who's still in that struggle, figuring it out. You know, it's like your old you who was working with Chase, but it wasn't feeling right. It wasn't fitting. It's like people who are in that, those crux points and struggling with where to go or where to turn. What sort of advice do you have? And the tailoring it to you more specifically would be maybe people attempting a huge, arduous challenge, something that is almost mind-bogglingly difficult, like Nolan's 14. Like, how do you attack major challenges like life, like mountain climbing? What's your advice?
Well, yeah, at first I was going to, like, before you said the major challenges thing, like just giving any advice, I was going to tell people to go adopt a dog. I mean, I'm half kidding, but I'm not really. Like, I tell everyone adopting a dog was the best thing I ever did in my life. And it was the best decision I ever made. And so, anyways, as far as, like, I think mental preparation is underrated, like, but you also have to do the work. And it's just this combination of convincing yourself and believing in yourself. And especially, like, if you have something really huge that, it, you know, your Nolan's might be a 50 miler, right? Like, it might be your first time doing an ultra or doing a 100 miler for the 10th time. But I'm just a huge believer in what your mind can do. And I'm a huge believer in visualizing. So I visualized finishing at the fish hatchery, which is where, if you're going north to south on Nolan, or excuse me, south to north on Nolan's, you finish at the fish hatchery. And I, over and over throughout training, before I'd go to sleep, whenever I thought of it, basically, I would think I would try to visualize myself actually finishing the entire thing. And in my mind, there was never any other alternative. It was, if I show up to start Nolan's, I'm going to finish. I just always had that mentality of, I'm going to get to the end, because I'm not going to start it unless I put enough work in. But then kind of coming back to the, like, getting yourself ready, it's also this thing where there's so much out of your control and it's so big. And that's true of any 100-miler, it's true of any race, it's true of any, like, monumental, huge task you have coming. I believe deeply in getting yourself mentally ready. And part of that for me has always been, like, actually visualizing it, and seeing it happen kind of in dream state before it actually happens. And it doesn't mean that everything will go that way, and I could have broken my ankle halfway. But I think I tell my friends this. I'm like, I got this from a buddy, Justin Ricks, who just says you can convince yourself you're Neo, you know, you're Neo. And I love that example. I use it all the time because it's so true. Like, if you believe in yourself enough mentally and you just convince yourself that you're the one, like,
meaning Neo from the Matrix, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
You can do anything if you think you're Neo is the idea. And
I love,
like,
it.
Because he told me that when he looked at me and he said, Hannes, you know, if you think you're Neo, you're Neo. I was like, dude, I know exactly what you mean. And it's so true. Like, if you get your mind into that place, and I don't think that's any substitute for preparation. Like, I think there's a little too much belief that you can just show up to something, be determined enough, and you'll get there. Like, you have to put the work in. You have to understand how large the activity is that you're going to be getting into, and you got to be prepared. And you know, Nolan's compared to, like, other races, they're all so different, but I think they all have in common is it's not just determination. Like, you gotta be mentally prepared. You have to have yourself physically ready too. Yeah.
And all right, just rapid fire, name one or two future goals. Something as crazy, you know, as, like, Nolan's 14 that is on the bucket list.
Well, UTMB is on my bucket list, and, like, doing really well at UTMB is on my bucket list. So, like, nice. If you're going to just give me, like, fantasy dream goals, it's to, you know, like, have a really strong American result at UTMB. I'll keep my actual ambitions to myself because people think I'm crazy. But, yeah, that's pretty overwhelmingly surrounding my mind as well. Do next year. And sweet. I, like, can't think of anything else. I think I wouldn't mind going back to Nolan someday. I think I could do it a tiny bit better. But that might never happen too. Like, it's so arduous that I think I'm really looking forward to having a race season next year.
Sweet. Ooh, I like it. If you know, if you think you're Neo, you're Neo, you got this.
You're Neo, baby.
All right, Hannes. It is it's been great to talk to you. I really appreciate your time. You're an inspiration. And yeah, keep rocking it out. I'll be interested to see what's next.
Well, thanks for having me on, dude. I appreciate you taking the time. Let me talk about my life and stuff.
All right, brother. Have a good day.
Cheers.
This wraps up another edition of the Get After It PDX podcast. For more information about today's guest, including social media links, please check out the show notes for this episode. Thanks for listening. Now it's your turn to get out there and get after it.